Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. Remember, remember, the 5th of November. Gunpowder, treason, and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. Welcome to The Rest is History. We are, of course, talking about the gunpowder plot and Bonfire Night, which is tomorrow, Tom Holland. Are you looking for... Are you a Bonfire Night aficionado?
Well, I'm not, because I'm very worried about hedgehogs.
Oh, because, yes. Yeah, I read this.
Because hedgehogs hibernate. Yeah. And so, this is exactly the time of the year they're looking for a large collection of, brushwood or something to settle down in. So they find... these large bonfires, and they think, oh, excellent, here's a place to stay for the winter. And then the next thing they know, they're being burnt to death. So I'm very worried about them.
Well, I think surely the answer to this is look out for hedgehogs, but you should have a bonfire, because it's very important to remember this shocking moment in 1605 when Guy Fawkes and co. tried to blow up the House of Parliament. Do you not think?
Well, so that was the question, wasn't it? In the doggerel that you just quoted, the famous doggerel.
Yeah, no reason.
Should it be remembered?
Yeah, of course it should.
I mean, it's interesting. I guess it should be remembered because it is an amazing story. It's absolutely kind of prototypical terrorist attack. Great drama.
Yeah.
But it's also fascinating for the various ways in which it's been remembered.
So the gunpowder plot. Now, I am conscious that we have lots of overseas listeners who unaccountably won't know what the gunpowder plot is.
What? So they don't celebrate it overseas.
Shockingly, in Catholic countries, they don't tend to celebrate it. So basically, it's 1605. This is a plot by Catholic conspirators with a man called Guy Fawkes, very much to the fore, to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Guy Fawkes is discovered, and the plot is foiled. And Tom, we have celebrated its defeat ever since, have we not?
Yes, and overseas listeners may have seen the film V for Vendetta, which is themed around Guy Fawkes Night. And there's a kind of mask with a figure with a beard, moustache, which has become very kind of popular with, all kinds of kind of protest movements. So you may have seen it with that. Anyway, it has been, I suppose to a degree, is still a big deal in England. And I would guess you could say that today, in a country that's becoming ever less overtly Protestant, and the whole narrative is about Protestants and Catholics, that it is actually starting to be forgot.
Tom, it saddens me, but I think you're right.
As a stout-hearted Englishman.
I'm a complete traditionalist when it comes to bonfire nights. You know, when I read about people in Lewes burning, they burn Pope Paul V or something, do they, in Sussex?
In Lewes, they do.
They always burn him. They always burn him, a Pope.
And they burn Guy Fawkes.
And Donald Trump.
But also, yes, they burn people who are in the news.
I utterly approve of that. I want to see apprentices constructing effigies of national enemies. You know,
do you think that they should put cats inside the?
I probably draw the line at the cats,
so that they then howl as the effigy burns, which they used to do.
Did they? I didn't know they used to put cats.
You're not that much of a traditionalist.
There's amazing stuff actually we'll come to in the second half of this about rioting, 19th century and stuff, and also bonfire night celebrations in America. Which is
that's a weird thing, isn't it?
I mean, that really, it's only weird, only seems weird now, but of course it wouldn't have seemed weird in the 18th century. We'll come to all that, because it's always thought that Bonfire Night is a peculiarly British, if not English, thing. But of course, for a long time, it wasn't. So it did spread to the colonies and so on. But we'll get on to that, because we should probably kick off with the plot itself, because it is an absolutely fantastic story, isn't it?
Well, it's, yes. Except that it's complicated, isn't it? Because
it is complicated, as all good terrorist plots are.
Well, it's very Le Carré. It's very Le Carré It's very Le Carré-esque, I guess, for two reasons. Firstly, that it's never entirely clear who the goodies and the baddies are.
That's right. Yeah.
Obviously, for most of 17th and 18th and into the 19th century in England, it was clear who the baddies were. The baddies were the evil Catholics who were trying to blow up Parliament. But actually, there's kind of skullduggery and oppression on both sides. But the second reason why it's very Le Carré-esque is that there's a kind of murk, and you're never entirely sure whether the details of how the plot came to be discovered are true or That's even right. really yeah. whether there was, you know, whether the entire thing was fabricated or not. I mean, I don't think it was. I think it was absolutely a genuine plot. But it has been argued that it was completely fabricated by Cecil.
Yes, who was James
the First, the son of Lord Burghley, who was Elizabeth the First minister. So it is a kind of thrillingly complicated story.
So let's give a bit of context, first of all. Maybe I'll say a bit about the context. So we're in the late 16th, early 17th century. So England has been through the Reformation. In Elizabeth's reign, there has been this sort of fear of Catholic conspiracy, hasn't there? There's been sort of Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is this huge saga of sort of Protestant martyrs being killed by evil Catholics. There's this sense of Jesuit conspirators flooding into England. I mean, actually, there's not many of them, but there's this sort of general paranoia about them. There's this unbelievably to our sort of 21st century eyes, there's this sense of a kind of evil empire. I think one historian called James Sharp calls it in his book, Remember, Remember. He sort of says, you know, there's this sense of an overarching Catholic conspiracy that involves the King of Spain, the Pope, all kinds of fifth columnists in England.
Well, and that's the Le Carré angle
yeah.
as well.
And yeah, the thing is that this isn't completely
no, of course
mad.
Not, because within Elizabeth's reign, the Spanish Armada had come.
Right.
And there are Spanish troops across the Channel in
Flanders. Yeah,
in Flanders.
Exactly. And of course, there's also been a huge massacre of Protestants in Paris in 1572 yeah. in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. The Dutch guy, William the Silent, has been assassinated in 1584.
And on top of that, perhaps the key thing is in 1570, the Pope Pius V had excommunicated Elizabeth as a heretic and had essentially said that it was the duty of any Catholic to get rid of her, perhaps to assassinate yeah. her. And yeah. so there was this. So I think, understandably, there is jitteriness and paranoia among the Elizabeth's regime and among Protestants more generally. And there's this kind of terrible the question that's always put to Catholics, the bloody question: whose side would you take if the Bishop of Rome or other prince by his authority should invade the realm by an army? Which is a kind of impossible question for a good Catholic and a patriotic Catholic to answer, because totally split loyalties.
My wife is Catholic, and I often ask her that question.
Mine is too. I haven't asked her, but I should.
You should, because it's good to know. You need to know, you know. You don't want to find out that you're harbouring a traitor in your own household, Tom.
No, that would be a shocker, wouldn't it?
But of course, so now there aren't many Catholics in England. What are there, 40,000 maybe? I mean, it's
that's the estimate of John Bossy, who was...
That's right. That's very contested exactly how many there are. They are... There's some in the north, in Yorkshire and Lancashire. There are gentry Catholics.
So it's the gentry that's the key, isn't it, for this story? Because basically there are swingeing fines imposed on people who don't go to the Church of England services.
Yeah, recusants.
And so essentially, increasingly, it becomes it becomes very, very expensive to be a Catholic. And of course, also it's gentry with houses where they can build priest holes and build up the apparatus that enables, particularly the Jesuits, but not only the Jesuits, priests who yeah. are coming over from Dowie, which is this kind of seminary that's been built for English priests to go back there. So they provide it, and the key figures in this are tend to be women, and they kind of leverage the fact that, in the opinion of the government, the kind of institutions that patrol how people are behaving, it's assumed that men are the head of the household, and there it's less significant what women are up to. But actually, it's women who are taking the lead in this, and that they play a kind of key role in providing links between the various recusant members of the gentry, particularly in the Midlands, and it's a Midland focused conspiracy as it emerges.
It is. I also wonder whether there's an element, though, Tom, that if you're a man and you're from the gentry, so you're from, I mean, for people who don't know, I mean, how would you describe that? The sort of, let's say, the upper middle class, for want of a better phrase, then you might want to be a lawyer, or you might want to be an MP, or you yeah. might want to be a teacher, or one of these things. And you can't do any of those things as a Catholic, because you have to swear the oath of supremacy. So basically, if you're practicing, believing Catholic, you as a man, you are shut out of public life, a lot of public life. unless you swear the oath. Now, the one thing about these laws is often they're not very harshly enforced because they're dependent on kind of local enforcement. And lots of kind of local bigwigs basically turn a blind eye. They know the Catholic down the road is fine, you know.
And in the 1590s, so, you know, that the Spanish Armada has come and gone, things are starting to ease off, things slightly kind of cool. So it's less stressful. And also the other thing that Catholics have to look forward to is the prospect of Elizabeth dying.
Yeah. And a new king from...
Or perhaps a queen.
Well, there's a bit of uncertainty, isn't
there? Yeah, there's a bit of uncertainty. So James VI of Scotland, son of Mary Queen of Scots, who was a Catholic, but has himself been raised a Protestant, is the obvious heir. But there is another possibility, the Infanta, who's the daughter of Philip II, who Catholics in England are very excited at the thought that she might. I think she's descended from John of Gaunt or something like that. So they are kind of, they're clinging to the hope either that the Infanta will succeed Elizabeth. That's a long stretch and it turns out not to work. Or that James, as the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, will be more favourable to Catholics than Elizabeth had been.
Which is not wrong because James, people, regular listeners,
friend
to the podcast,
of the show.
Well, no, that James is a friend of the show, slobbering, tongue too big for his mouth, wisest fool in Christendom.
But very smart.
Loves a theological debate. And the thing about James is he's a Calvinist, so he's a Scottish Calvinist, but he's also a believer in the divine rights of kings and an absolute monarchy. So he is not keen on kind of ultra-Protestant political ideology. And Catholics think, well, he's a bit ambiguous. You know, James is a great man for unity and consent. He wants a consensus. So maybe when he comes in, as you say, his mother was a Catholic, so he maybe he'll relax a lot of these laws.
And also, the guy who said that James was the wisest fool in Christendom was Henry IV of France.
Yeah, look what happened to him.
Well, exactly. So 2 points there. So he'd been a Protestant who then becomes a Catholic. Paris is worth the mass is his famous quip about that. But he does, he ends up being assassinated. Yeah, so exactly. Who's the fool there? James is actually, I think, a very smart operator. And one of the things that he does very effectively is to kind of keep his options open.
Yeah.
So in the months and the weeks before Elizabeth's death, a prominent Catholic, Thomas Percy, who I think is the second cousin of the Earl of Northumberland.
Yeah, relative of the Duke of Northumberland.
One of the great, great kind of nobles in England, rules the North effectively. Thomas Percy goes up to meet James, and James kind of prevaricates, says, yeah, okay, I might, you know, get rid of the recusancy laws, might make it legitimate for Catholics to worship. And Thomas Percy comes back and he spreads this, and Catholics in England want to believe this. So they are looking forward to James's accession in a spirit of hope, which that spirit of hope then gets dashed when James becomes King of England and heads south.
Yeah, because he's not going to... It would actually have been politically very foolish for him, I think, to have relaxed these laws, because obviously he's coming down south. There's a lot of suspicion and, you know, Scotophobic, if that's a word, hostility. This Scottish guy is pitching up. Is he going to change everything? And obviously, at first, quite sensibly, he doesn't want to change everything. There is two other plots.
A couple of plots, aren't there?
The gunpowder plot. There's a plot called the Bye Plot, for example, where a load of Catholics have a plan that they'll kind of kidnap James and force him to relax the laws.
Is it Catholic? I'm not sure it is Catholics.
Oh, is it not Catholics?
No, because Walter Raleigh, there are two
plots. You're right, there is the Walter Raleigh
is involved in it as well.
He's the main plot, I think, isn't
but
he?
But the chief Jesuit, Father Henry Garnett, again, friend of the show, because we mentioned him in the Macbeth episode, I think that he kind of tips the nod on that, on one of them.
That's right, he does.
Somehow he gets to know about it, and he tips the nod. So James, because of those plots, is twitchier than he might have been.
Yeah.
And basically he just decides that he's not going to go with it. And lurking in the shadows, we have a question from Fiona H. Did Robert Cecil know, instigate, enable, encourage, smile knowingly in the months and weeks before? We might come to that. But Robert Cecil, who is the son of Lord Burghley, Elizabeth's great kind of right-hand man, he essentially is the kind of the power behind the throne. He's very short, isn't he?
He's 5 feet tall. Do you know what Elizabeth used to call him? She called him her little elf.
Did she? I know that James called him Pygmy.
Pygmy. Yeah. They were more forthright times, weren't they? Yes, they I like were. To think that. I hope John Bercow is not listening to this podcast.
So Robert Cecil is kind of lurking in the background.
Yeah,
and he's essentially, you know, he wants to keep things as they are, and I think essentially that a group of young noblemen, young kind of members of the gentry in the Midlands, basically decide that this is a terrible thing. And the key figure...
Not Guy Fawkes.
It's a guy called Robert Catesby.
Yes, he's from Warwickshire originally, Warwickshire gentry, born in 1573. He'd been off to Douai, hadn't he? He'd been to this seminary over the channel, and then he'd come back. And he's basically...
And he's married a Protestant. He's married a Protestant heiress.
Yeah.
She died. He then goes back to Catholicism, but this time he's kind of been radicalised.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, we read so much now about people being radicalised and becoming terrorists. He clearly has been radicalised, but he doesn't fit the pattern of the 21st century radicalised person, I don't think, because he's from his life isn't that terrible for him. I mean, I know his wife has died and stuff, but I mean, he's got lots going for him. He's very charismatic, very popular.
They are, the whole group that he gets around him are basically, they're kind of massive lads. They're the kind of Bullingdon club. They are.
That's the extraordinary thing, isn't it?
They fence, they gallop, you know. Yeah. And I think that a part of it is, you know, you mentioned that they essentially their careers are going nowhere, and these are the kind of guys who assume that their careers should be going somewhere, so their hopes of advancement are frustrated. So I'm sure that's an element.
They meet, they cook it up. They even cook it up in the pub. I mean, where is it? The Duke and Drake in the Strand are on the 20th of May, 1604. So it's Catesby and I think five others.
One of whom is Thomas Percy.
Yeah, so he's going to be
Thomas
very
Percy, and he comes in and he walks into the pub and he says, "Shall we always, gentlemen, talk and never do anything?"
That's the motto of this podcast, Tom. When I read that, I thought, that's me and Tom Holland.
But I mean, that's a kind of, you know, that's a very familiar kind of phrase from terrorist groups.
Yeah. We talk and talk and talk, we never do anything.
We never actually do anything.
And it's also that sort of worship of the deed for its own sake, because they don't really have a very good plan, I don't think. So their plan is basically they're going to blow up the Houses of Parliament at the state opening of Parliament. So you've got James, you've got the House of Lords, you've got the MPs, you've got basically the entire political establishment blown sky high. And then there's that question that hangs in the air that lots of our listeners have asked, what are they going to do next? And their plan is they're going to get James's third child, who is Elizabeth, who's what, 8, 9?
Yeah.
They're going to go, she's up in Coventry. God knows why, but she's in Coventry. You've been to Coventry on one of your trips.
Yeah, wonderful.
You?
Yeah.
So she's sort of Tom Holland of Stuart Princesses. She's in Coventry. They're going to go up to Coventry. They're going to kidnap her and they're going to use her. But I mean, it's such a stupid idea.
It's a terrible idea, isn't it?
It is a terrible idea. I mean, I was thinking what you would compare it to, and it's worse than the Stauffenberg plot. So it's a bit like the Stauffenberg plot, and it's the 1944 get rid of Hitler. So it's decapitate the leadership. But the Stauffenberg plotters had a real sense of how they would seize power in Berlin, what they would do next, and so on. These guys in the pub, I don't think they have a very good.
It's also slightly that they're kind of it's young men impatient with their elders, which is also something that you see now with a lot of say Islamist inspired terrorist attacks. You'll get kind of, you know, their parents saying, "We had no idea," and pretty much the same there.
Yeah, I think even at the time, Tom, one of them, a guy called Thomas Winter, when Catesby brings up the idea of the plan, he says, "This is a terrible idea." But in that classic way that happens when a group of kind of five blokes and, you know, young blokes are together, the others kind of shout him down and he says, "Oh, okay, fine, I'll go along with it."
And Catesby, as you said, is everybody says he's unbelievably charismatic. So charismatic that he gets played by Kit Harington, aka Jon Snow.
Is Kit Harington that charismatic though, or is he not
Tom? Yes, I thought he was a trifle wooden. I thought that he didn't measure up to the charisma of Catesby. But also Catesby has, I mean, so they say, "Why are we going to blow up Parliament?" And he says, basically it's the place that they have done all the mischief, or something to that effect. You know, this is the place where they're doing us down. And there's a kind of simplicity to that, isn't there? Kind of starkness.
I suppose so. There was a starkness to it. But of course the plot, what you need with any good story of a plot is a series of shambleses and delays. And you get that. With-
yes. But also you need someone, presumably if you're going to blow it up with gunpowder, you need opportunity and you need someone who knows how to handle gunpowder. So the opportunity comes from the fact that Northumberland, the Earl of Northumberland, is able to pull strings and get Thomas Percy appointed to some kind of honorary position.
A gentleman pensioner. What a great thing to be.
Which means that he has ready access to the Houses of Parliament. And that means that he can start bringing in barrels of gunpowder.
Yeah.
And no one's going to ask questions. And they're not put in a cellar, are they? That's what we always say. It's actually a kind of
I was surprised at that. Yeah, when I started my in-depth research, that it's actually a ground floor storeroom.
Dominic, who do they employ as their gunpowder expert?
Well, he's Guy or Guido Fawkes, isn't he?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So he's a Yorkshireman.
He's a Yorkshireman.
And he's a very dashing fellow, Guy Fawkes.
Yeah, he really is. So he came from school in York that is still going strong today, St. Peter's School. And in 1992, the head boy of St. Peter's School said that Guy Fawkes was not exactly a role model.
Oh.
But in a way, he is. I mean, he's born Protestant, becomes Catholic as a boy, I think, and goes off and really makes a name for himself in Flanders, fighting with the Spanish.
He's very brave, isn't he?
He's very brave, very charismatic, got a sensational kind of red beard.
Big hat,
all the works. And he gets employed by Catholic conspirators to go to Spain to see if they can persuade Philip III, son of Philip II, who sent the Armada, to basically, you know, invade England. And the King of Spain says no. But that is when Guy changes his name to Guido.
Right. I didn't know that because I was puzzled about the... Now, one thing about the gunpowder, an interesting thing, the reason they're able to get... You were saying about sort of means, motive and opportunity. One reason they're able to get the gunpowder is that England had been at war with Spain. And James, when he became king, basically called it off because he said, it's going nowhere. It's a complete waste of time. So actually, this gunpowder is on the market and it's cheap. There's no need for it. So they're able to get all this gunpowder and they bring it in. But the gunpowder is there too long. Because
there's plague, right?
Because as so often in 17th century England, 16th, 17th century England, there's a plague. So Parliament gets prorogued. It gets pushed back. So they thought it was going to be earlier.
It's like a COVID delay.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a bit of
a lockdown
style scenario. Parliament has been, the opening of Parliament is postponed to the 5th of November, 1605. So a lot later than they were hoping. Anyway, the gunpowder just kind of sits there, doesn't it, in this sort of storeroom.
Buried beneath wood.
Yeah, tons of wood. And you would think, well, why doesn't somebody find it? But the Palace of Westminster and that complex is a completely different beast from what there is today. It's just this great rambling, sprawling mess of buildings and there's no security. You know, there's people going in and out all the time. The storerooms are full of clutter. So it's completely understandable why nobody detects all this. And then you get this letter. Now, this is such an interesting story.
The Monteagle letter.
Yes.
So Monteagle is a nobleman with Catholic sympathies.
Yeah, I think that's right. Is he a Catholic himself?
I can't remember, but he's floating. Basically, he's floating around on the edge of Catholic conspiracies.
That's right. I think he had been a Catholic and now possibly
and
isn't.
I think he's like the Earl of Northumberland, who is Catholic in his heart.
Right.
Say.
Yeah.
So he, shortly before Parliament is due to open, his servant comes in and says he's been handed a letter by a mysterious figure. And this letter, when it's deciphered, says you should keep away from Parliament.
They shall receive a terrible blow, this Parliament.
Terrible blow.
And yet they shall not see who hurts them.
And Monteagle takes it to Robert Cecil, who by this point has become the Earl of Salisbury.
Yeah.
He's
good to see Salisbury getting a name check.
Good to see Salisbury, so all over him. And Cecil takes it to James, and so it is that people are sent down to inspect, and they find the gunpowder, and they find a shadowy figure.
But they don't at first, though.
No, they inspect it first, and they don't see it.
They say, oh, it's just a load of old wood. Who cares? Yeah, fine.
Or do they? I mean, this is all part of the Le Carré murk. Are they waiting so that they can capture the people responsible?
Yeah, because they say at the time they see a tall and very desperate fellow But they're like, oh, it's fine. There's probably nothing wrong with it. And then James says, well, again, this is unclear. The propaganda basically says, James says, no, go back and check again. Yes. in a Scottish accent. And back they go. So it's the sort of early hours of the 5th of November, isn't it? When back they go.
And they find a booted, cloaked, hatted figure with three fuses.
Yeah, called John Johnson. John Johnson. Good alias.
Who is he?
He's Guy Fawkes. Oh, my goodness.
You've blown it, Dominic.
Well, I mean, unlike Guy Fawkes, ironically. So they find Guy Fawkes. And of course, so much of this could be untrue, right? That's what's so fascinating. So go back to the letter.
Yeah.
It's often thought that the letter is sent to Lord... I mean, the letter is such a dopey thing to do. Sent to Lord Mounteagle by his brother-in-law, Francis Tresham, who's one of the conspirators.
And who's been very reluctant about it.
Yeah, who doesn't want his brother-in-law to get blown really up. But some people
express reservations.
But some people say that this may not be the case, that Lord Mounteagle may have dictated the letter himself and then
taken
it.
So Antonia Fraser, who's written the kind of the great narrative account of the Gunpowder Plot, that's her thesis.
And is that because she thinks Tresham has told Mounteagle personally and they just want to find a way for Mounteagle to pass it on, basically?
That if Mounteagle knows about it because he's been on the edge of the conspiracy, he needs to kind of cover his back.
Yeah.
So that he can explain how it is that he knows about the conspiracy. And this, you know, the letter is crucial to the whole story that then gets revealed to a shell-shocked Protestant nation about what's been going on. So it's really, he gets a pension, all kinds of things. So you can't in any way have Mounteagle being kind of fingered as a suspect.
But also, that letter is the 26th of October. And they don't then, and they wait and wait and wait, the authorities, before pouncing at the very last minute. And so ever since, lots of people have said, do they wait and wait and wait because Robert Cecil is basically looking for the most melodramatic possible story to tell to the public? Does he know about it? Or indeed, did he devise the plot? Was it a kind of false flag operation?
I think no, but I think it's entirely plausible that he may have scoped out the fact. And this is, you mentioned about the delay.
Yeah.
That the gunpowder had been there for quite a few months. Basically, it turns out that the plot would never have worked because the gunpowder had decayed. So it was
not
never
such a good story, is it? When you light the gunpowder and nothing happens.
No. And so perhaps, you know, it's entirely feasible that Cecil had checked it out and realised that there wasn't any danger. And therefore, it was absolutely fine to leave it there and they could catch them all red-handed.
Although, Tom, the counter-argument to that is that what's in it for Cecil to cook this up? Because it's not like he uses the gunpowder plot for some hideous crackdown on Catholics. You know, it's not a kind of Reichstag fire kind of event, is it? I mean, they don't use it. I guess politically it rallies support for the regime, but it's not like he can use this for some repressive purpose of his own.
Yes. I mean, it also, well, James's key interest at the moment when this happens is forging a union between England and Scotland. That's his focus. He's not really interested in issues about Catholics or whatever. So it has been argued that Cecil, who was more interested in that, might have used it to try and get James back on track. And Cecil's very good at, you know, he takes the letter to James and allows James to decipher it and pretend that he's worked it out.
Yeah.
So Cecil plays a very kind of astute game here. But we don't know. And that is part of the fascination of it. You know, who's deceiving whose plot is it, essentially? Yeah. And I think we should take a break here. And when we come back, we should look at what happens after John Johnson, a.k.a. Guy Fawkes.
I gave it away. I'm gutted myself.
You did.
I mean, no one would have known before this.
and then look at the reverberations of the plot right the way through the centuries up to the present day.
Splendid. We shall see you, fireworks in hand, after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, Was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. This is a 5th of November Guy Fawkes Bonfire Night special. And in the first half, we left scene absolutely hanging. John Johnson, a.k.a. Guy Fawkes, has been discovered. He gets taken to the Tower of London, where he is tortured to try and find out his identity. He's incredibly, I mean, he's very, very brave. He holds out for a long time. And in the meanwhile, however, Cecil's agents are going out there. They're kind of working out what's been going on. And immediately on the 5th of November, an arrest warrant is issued for Thomas Percy, who, it is said on this arrest warrant, privy to one of the most horrible treasons that ever was contrived. And while Guy Fawkes is being tortured in the Tower of London, Percy, Catesby, various others of the conspirators are galloping northwards. Parliament hasn't blown up, but they are still committed to trying to seize Princess Elizabeth.
Yeah, so this is an element of shambles, isn't it? Just on Guy Fawkes being tortured, you know what? He says to James, he says, "I want to blow all you Scots back to Scotland."
He does. Yes, and we've got a question here on that from Annie Scott. Did Guy Fawkes hate the Scots? If so, why? And if he was certain that the two nations could not be reconciled for long, is he a most unlikely champion for Scottish independence? He did hate the Scots.
Did he hate the Scots? That's very strong.
He said there is a natural hostility between the English and the Scots.
All right, fair enough. Well, yeah. I mean, probably a lot of, I mean, some listeners would probably agree with him.
He was very, very Scotophobic.
Right.
And as you said, yes, he told his Scottish inquisitors that he wanted to blow them back to Scotland.
Anyway, I sidetracked you. You were talking about them. So, this is an interesting thing, and this comes to the counterfactual element that lots of people have asked about. What would have happened if the plotters had succeeded? Because actually the conspirators, as they ride across the country, at first they don't tell people it's failed. They sort of say, hurrah.
They try to raise the country.
And obviously, you know, there's this dreadful sort of sequence of events where they're riding to various country houses and banging on the door. Will you rise up and join us? People are just like, no, go away. Shut the door in their faces.
Yeah.
So they end up basically doing this Tom Holland style peregrination across the Midlands of England, where they don't get to Coventry. Don't they pitch up near Dudley, Stourbridge? As a man of the West Midlands, I have to say, a slightly unglamorous location.
Possibly it was more glamorous then.
Maybe. They're at a place called Holbeach House in the end, aren't they, in Staffordshire?
Yeah.
On the 8th of November near Dudley. And
there is an explosion.
Yeah, ironically. There's all kinds of stuff.
They accidentally set off some gunpowder. And I think some of them get killed, some of them get injured. And then there's a massive shootout.
There's a very Wild West style shootout, isn't
there? Wild West shootout. And there's one of the guys who's come to arrest them with a single bullet shoots both Percy and Catesby.
But Catesby, you know how he dies. Now, I find this too good to be true. He supposedly dies he's got a crucifix and he's cradling a picture of the Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe real, real experts on this will say, no, this is absolutely true. But that seems too good to be true for me. It's a very Hollywood kind of ending, isn't it?
Well, Catesby's death basically means that it's because Catesby dies that we know, you know, that so much remains in shadow.
Yeah.
Because he was the kind of the motor, the inspiration, the organizer of the entire plot. So that is why it then becomes all the more important for the Inquisitors to work out from Guy Fawkes what's been going on. And he holds out very, very bravely, but he gets broken. You're not supposed to torture people, are you? It's against the common law.
Yeah, but they do it anyway.
And to be fair, the Protestant authorities are very, very twitchy about it, because the accusation against the Catholic powers in Europe is that they torture, whereas freeborn Englishmen don't torture people. But with this, they make an exception. And you can be manacled, so you basically hang from your wrists and you slowly get stretched, and then you go on the rack. Everyone is always broken on the rack. By the end, I mean, famously, Guy Fawkes has a kind of swaggering signature to begin with, and by the end, it's just a kind of broken squiggle.
Yeah. And then, so they're put on trial. There's eight survivors left, aren't they? They're put on trial in January 1606. The presiding judge is Sir Edward Cook, who's the great father of the common law. And, you know, he makes sure that the whole thing is blown into this wider conspiracy that the Jesuits are behind. And
he says in the course of the prosecution that people will find this an extraordinary story, that people will not, you know, they won't believe it could ever have happened.
Yeah, but he clearly does believe it happened. Well, yeah, at least he purports to believe it's happened. So they're sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. We all know what that means. Hanged, brought down, mutilated,
castrated.
Privy parts are cut off and burned before your eyes.
We haven't had
some
genital mutilation for a while. So
no. Luckily for Guy Fawkes, he's been so, you know, ravaged by torture that he dies pretty much straight away.
So four of them get hanged by St. Paul's, and the other four get hanged actually in Parliament, Westminster Yard outside Parliament. And I think Guy Fawkes, he breaks his neck.
Yeah.
So he dies on the scaffold. And then there's a further execution which we talked about in the Macbeth episode, which is Henry Garnet, the head of the Jesuits in England, who gets arrested, interrogated, sentenced, hung, drawn, and quartered. And the question with him that also is kind of unclear is the degree to which he was involved. Because he does know about the plot.
He knew about it.
He says it's the confessional. He can't reveal it, and he says that he has tipped off, you know, people in Rome, the Pope, to try and stop it. But against that, there's the fact that he had tipped off the authorities about the earlier plot when James came to the throne.
Counts for nothing though, Tom. You've got to keep doing it. You've got to keep tipping off. You can't tip off and then stop tipping off.
Yeah, so it's unclear. So there's a lot of murk there.
But what's interesting, though, right, is that what I found fascinating was that James himself, who was the projected target, he does not inflate this afterwards into a general attack on Catholics.
No, he doesn't.
So he gives a speech to Parliament on the 9th of November, and he says, no foreign power was involved in this. You know, he doesn't take the opportunity, I suppose, because he's just concluded peace with Spain. So he thinks, well, I'm not going to stir things up again. But also he goes out of his way to say, you know, most English Catholics are just a bit misguided. They're very loyal. They wouldn't be party to any of this.
So in that, rather like George Bush after 9/11, desperate not to blame it on
yeah,
American Muslims. But unlike George Bush, in that Bush, of course, does blame it on foreign power.
But he's so kind of this little thing of it. This is not true Catholicism.
He doesn't do that. You know, Catholicism is a religion of peace. He doesn't go in for that. No. But I think it's worth asking. I think that's impressive because the scale of what was being plotted really was horrific. So we've got a question from Simon Girdleston. Has anyone ever worked out if the gunpowder had gone off, how big the explosion would have been?
The answer to that question is very unexpected, isn't it, Tom? It's very unexpected indeed. It's a top historian who you wouldn't predict.
top historian. It's Top Gear. It's Top Gear's Richard Hammond, who in the ITV special Gunpowder Plot Exploding the Legend, got experts in to work that out. And the answer was, it would have blown everything up. So it would have blown up the Houses of Parliament, Westminster Hall, Westminster Abbey would have come crashing down. So it would have been absolute carnage.
It's 36 barrels of gunpowder. I mean, it's a lot. That's a lot.
If it had gone off, but of course it was never going to go off.
But if they'd got their way, we're talking about hundreds, certainly hundreds of people, and not just the great and the good either. I mean, this is where your sort of 9/11 comparison comes in. You know, there would have been all kinds of servants, guards.
Yeah. The carnage would have been absolutely horrendous.
People scurrying about with petitions, passers-by, sightseers, you know, traders.
Yeah.
All these kinds of people would have been
killed. Which in turn then begs the obvious question, which Simon James Jones asks, if it had been successful, would it have initiated a Catholic revolution? And he correctly says he attempts to create one despite the plot failure suggests there was no appetite for it. And then Simon Hodge, what's the hope of some kind of Catholic seizure of power if the plot had succeeded, realistic or even plausible? I usually assume success would just have meant even worse repression afterwards.
So the person who's actually dealt with this in a really nice essay on the BBC website is our previous guest, Professor Ronald Hutton.
Yeah.
And he goes into this and he says, well, we know. Because the plotters rode about the countryside saying that the plot had worked and nobody rose up. So even if the plot had worked, the same would have happened. They would have ridden around the countryside and people would not have risen up. And actually, he says, I think utterly plausibly, what would have happened is in the hours and days after the plot, there would have been a colossal and very bloody repression of English Catholics.
And the person who would have become king, because Henry the Prince of Wales, a charismatic Protestant, Protestant hero already, he would have died in the explosion, which would have left James's younger son, Charles, to become Charles I.
As he later in reality. But and, a very different reign, a very different person.
So Ronald Hutton suggests, again, seems to be completely plausibly, that Charles, growing up against the background of this attack, this murder of his family, would have become both an absolutist, which in a sense, you know, Charles did, but a radical Protestant absolutist, which would have got the radical Puritan opinion that in due course go to war with him and end up putting him on the block, would absolutely got, you know, he'd have generated enormous radical Protestant enthusiasm. And there would have been a kind of absolutist Protestant regime. And then Hutton suggests there would in the long run have been a revolution.
Yeah, it's great. I love a bit of counterfactual.
Yeah, I love a bit of counterfactual.
Even though we dissed it in our counterfactual episode, but we reserve the right to change our minds when Ronald Hutton is involved. And what's also interesting about this, so that's the plot. That's the counterfactual. Now, the commemoration. The movement to commemorate it starts straight away. So January 1606, a fellow called Sir Edward Montague, he introduces a bill for public thanksgiving. And they say let's have an annual service, and that annual service of thanksgiving remains in the prayer book for 250 years or so until 1859, and is then shamefully, in my view, taken out.
Is that where it all went wrong for the Church of England?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. I mean, I think it should have been every month, frankly, not every year. So straight away. But what's interesting is that at the beginning, I mean, they do have, so things, they often had bells and bonfires and things like that in the 17th century. But Guy Fawkes is not part of the story, really, at that stage. No. And indeed, not part of the story for a very long time.
Well, the thing I love about the commemorations is that Charles I, obviously, you know, he fights the Civil War, head gets chopped off, you get the Protectorate. And so many of the kind of traditional Christian festivals punctuate the year, get banned, but Bonfire Night doesn't. So they're still throughout the Protectorate, they're celebrating the escape of Charles I's father, the king, from people who wanted to kill him, which is kind of fabulous.
But they have even at that stage, they have fireworks and they have bonfires.
Pepys sees them, doesn't he?
Well, Pepys in 1660, I mean, obviously you can see where they're doing it in 1660. The monarchy has been restored. Charles II is back. You know, this is his grandfather. His grandfather's escape. They have a huge bonfire and fireworks, and Pepys records it in his diary. And then in 1664, do you know what he does on Bonfire Night, Tom? He goes to see Macbeth.
Of course, yes, perfect.
Yeah.
Yes.
He goes to Simabeth, and on the way home, their coach has to be diverted because there are so many bonfires. I mean, it all adds up.
But then November the 5th, 1666, doesn't he say, I've seen no bonfires? Because obviously having huge bonfires a few months after the Great Fire of London would not be sensitive timing at all.
It'd be poor form.
The other thing that kind of swells the mood of Protestant celebration that you're celebrating on the 5th of November is that 1688, the Glorious Revolution, when the Catholic James II is forced to flee following the invasion of the Dutch Prince of Orange.
This is your moment now to talk about the Dutch.
Yes.
For the duration of this podcast series. This is the allotted time to talk about the Dutch.
The Stadtholder, descendant of William the Silent, who'd been assassinated. Leader of a Protestant war against the Catholic absolutism of Louis XIV. And he lands at Torbay on the 5th of November. And his birthday is the 4th of November.
Yeah. Bishop Gilbert Burnett, a year later, on the 5th of November, he preaches to the House of Lords and he says, all this proves, and this is a direct quote, we are God's favourite people. Because God has chosen this day and he just gives us
everything.
You know, it's the day that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
The defeat of Plots, the arrival of Dutchmen, you know, what's not to like?
So it's very much the idea of England as a chosen nation and a Protestant nation. And it kind of cements in anti-popery as the kind of the great, vibrant English, kind of British tradition. Because obviously William III goes on to invade Ireland, to defeat Catholic armies there. And so the legacy of that endures to this day in Northern Ireland. But in England, it does start to become complicated because certainly by the beginning of the 19th century, the idea that Catholics are the inveterate enemies of Protestant England has been complicated by the fact that lots of Catholics have been executed in Paris under the French Revolution. And Protestant Englishmen have kind of woken up to the realization that there might be kind of foes worse than Catholics.
So this is the point at which I think Guy Fawkes comes in.
Yes.
So you can see there are lots of plays about Guy Fawkes in the early 19th century. And there's this sort of growing sense of Guy Fawkes becoming a bit of an anti-hero. You know, a swashbuckling, romantic.
Well, he's kind of a hero of pantomimes and things, isn't he?
He is. Plays, there's lots of comedies about him, bizarrely. Yes.
And it's nothing about the Protestant-Catholic divide.
There's a revival of that in the 1850s when the Catholic hierarchy is reintroduced into England.
But what about when 1829, the Catholic Emancipation?
I don't think that did make a big, massive... Well, maybe it did and I just haven't picked up on it. One thing we haven't mentioned, of course, is the export of this. So what's really fascinating is that throughout the 18th century, people are celebrating it with such gusto in America. So there's all sorts of... They call it Pope Day in New York. And they burn effigies of the Pope, the Devil, and Bonnie Prince Charlie.
That's a good range.
It's a range that makes sense, right? They're all on the same team. They're on Team Antichrist. And in Boston, the rival North and South Ends, kind of working class districts, they both produce popes. And there's a big thing in Boston on Bonfire Night where you try and grab the other district's pope and burn that as well as your own.
Great.
So it becomes a massive punch up to try and get the other side's pope and then burn it. I think that's
better than the Super Bowl, isn't it?
The fact that Boston has turned its back on that tradition, I find very sad. I know they've had a lot of Irish and Italian immigration, and there's a lot of Catholics now. But come on, they can put their confessional stuff to one side.
I suppose also they've had a revolution that's got rid of the British.
Yes.
King.
So you know what George Washington said about Bonfire Night?
No. What did George Washington say?
A ridiculous and childish custom. I mean, that just confirms my view that George Washington is one of the most boring men who ever lived. Very dull man.
Well, we cancelled him, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. His statue deserves to come down for his attitude to Bonfire Night alone.
And I see that they've cancelled Thomas Jefferson as well.
Yeah, probably another Bonfire Night skeptic.
We were ahead of the curve there. right, anyway, so we are alienating all our American listeners with that.
Well, I'll tell you who we should please. Therefore, we need to win listeners in Guildford to make up for it. because Guildford was a real bonfire night place in the mid 19th century. So throughout the 1850s and 1860s,
Surrey, all the American listeners who've
it's a commuter town basically now. It would be taken over by people called the Guildford Guys, who were a mob, and it was a no go area for the police. The Guildford Guys were rampaged.
Imagine Guildford as a no-go area.
A no-go area because the mob would take it over on bonfire night, just smashing stuff up and fighting. And in 1863, they had to send an infantry and dragoons to deal with the people of Guildford because they were so overexcited about bonfire night.
Well, the character of Surrey towns really changed, don't they?
Yeah. So obviously, Guy Fawkes, I think, ends up looming larger and larger.
I mean, it becomes so penny for the guy. Small boys, they make kind of figures, kind of human figures, which they call the guy, and they put him in go-karts, didn't they?
Push him around. I did kind of build a guy.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So did I. I loved the penny for the guy. Well, I'm very sorry that it
And this is where American listeners can feel pleased, because basically there was a tradition where small boys would push this guy around in a go-kart and essentially extort money. So yeah, penny for the guy. But that tradition now has been taken over by the American custom of Halloween.
Yeah.
So the guys, I mean, I haven't seen a guy for
no.
ages.
Also, the other tradition I remember from, so this is 1970s, is the tradition was that fireworks have become quite domestic. You know, you bought fireworks, you did them in your back garden. The tradition was that of the 20 fireworks, 10 didn't go off.
Yeah.
And the other 10 basically went off in your father's face.
Yeah.
And it was basically, you know, it was kind of party season at A&E.
Yes.
Because it was just full of middle-aged men lost an eye because a firework had gone off in their face or something.
So I suppose the decline of that might be down to health and safety.
I think,
I'm sure it must also be down to sensitivities over anti-Catholic celebrations.
Do you think that's really true? I mean,
I think a bit.
Among the drippiest, most pious.
No, I think it is a bit. And I think it's also been complicated by nervousness about Islamist terrorism a bit.
I do think that.
I think the idea of celebrating what is essentially a kind of sectarian festival has become, dare I say, problematic.
I'm going to two bonfire nights.
Of course you are. Of course you are, because you're the robust voice of Middle England. Yeah.
But I'm going to warn, do you know where the first one is? It's at Soho Farmhouse. You can't get much more robust Middle England than that. Where Harry met Meghan.
Well, I'm sure Meghan doesn't approve of it.
Oh, she'd be. I mean, so how is she? They could well end up on the Lewis bonfire, because in Lewis, which is this place, it's in Sussex, isn't it, Lewis?
Yeah.
So they
home get of Gideon Mantell, who we talked about in the dinosaur episode.
Right. They get 80,000 people lining the streets because they have these colossal effigies. They've had Margaret Thatcher. They've had George Bush. They've had Osama bin Laden. They've had Jerry Halliwell. They've had all the big names. They've had David Cameron, Wayne Rooney, Donald Trump. They had six Donald Trumps one year. And they always pick people who've been in the news and set them on fire. And then there's always sort of a little bit of outrage in the newspapers afterwards. How could you possibly burn Wayne Rooney or whoever? So I wouldn't be surprised to see Harry and Meghan on that. I'm not saying I agree with it, for those listeners who are big Meghanophiles. But do you not think that's plausible, Tom?
I think it's plausible, yeah.
Who would you like to burn? Who would you burn a bond if you had to do a?
Oh, that's a good question. Do you know, it's going to sound very witty. I'm not really the burning type.
I know you're not. I knew you wouldn't answer the question.
Who would you like to burn?
Oh God, so many, so many people.
Who's head of your long list?
I don't know. I to be honest, I find it very hard to narrow it down.
Okay.
I'd probably burn some of our rival history podcasters. How about that?
That's a good one. Yes, I like that. Okay, so we've ducked that for our very different reasons. But one way in which Guy Fawkes has kind of endured. So we mentioned earlier about V for Vendetta.
Yes.
Which is
Alan Moore's comic. Very good comic.
So in the 80s. Although, I mean, you can't, because it revolves around the whole premise. It's an alternative history of the 80s, isn't it?
Yeah.
In which the premise is that Michael Foote wins the general election in 1983.
Yeah, very implausible in my opinion.
That was never going to happen.
No.
So Michael Foote wins the election in 1983.
I'm so glad we've got Michael Foote into this podcast.
He unilaterally disarms Britain. There's then a nuclear war. Britain escapes the nuclear war because of Michael Foote. But then there's a fascist takeover.
Yeah.
There's a kind of evil dictator, and there's a shadowy figure who's basically Guy Fawkes, who ends up blowing up Parliament.
That's right. There's a very poor film of this, but I think it's a really brilliant graphic novel. A great window into the sort of paranoia of the 80s.
It's very Wiltshire-phobic.
Is it?
Yes.
Is that where there's a concentration camp in Wiltshire?
Yes, at Lark Hill, which is just above Stonehenge.
Oh, Tom. And you whinge about a tunnel and it's a concentration. You could have had a concentration camp.
He's made it up. Right, made it up. So I boycott it. I think it's unacceptable bigotry against Wiltshire.
Okay.
I
didn't think that was the bigotry.
I think he chose Lark Hill because he'd been on a walking holiday across at Salisbury Plain, and somebody was rude to him and refused him a drink of water in Lark Hill.
Oh.
So he's immortalised it as this.
Wow.
Oh, and also in that there's a kind of port and down, which is also on Salisbury Plain, kind of port and down biological weapon centre.
There
which,
is.
Which leaks a kind of a plague.
God, he's really got it in for Wiltshire.
He really has. Yeah, he really has. But there's a kind of COVID-y type scenario of a virus escaping from a government lab. But that kind of established these idea that these masks, Guy Fawkes masks, and I think Anonymous used it, who are kind of radical group online.
That's right.
The Occupy movement were very keen on it. So those are on the left. And then on the right, you've got the Guido Fawkes website, which is a kind of conservative anarchist.
That's a very good point. Website. Yeah, so Guy Fawkes has become a sort of generic anti-establishment icon.
So on the Guido Fawkes website, I think the tagline is "the only honest man to enter Parliament."
Yeah,
the only man to enter Parliament with honest intent.
Which is
an old joke, which has been kind of recycled because the whole premise of the website is that it's gossip that's designed to.
Of course, the gunpowder plotters were not libertarians, anarchists, proto-socialists or any of these things.
No.
They, Robert Catesby's ideal world would presumably have been a sort of rather like 17th century France or something, a more absolute monarchy.
Yeah, with him in a leading position,
yeah.
I think.
So.
It was all about social advancement.
Yes. As you say, it's Bullingdon Club boys who haven't got the jobs they wanted.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So is that it?
Yeah, I think the last embers are dying out. I'm trying to think of a bonfire related metaphor. And it's not really working.
The hedgehogs have been taken to safety. I think that's the note on which we should end. We should anyone who's building a bonfire remember to check it for hedgehogs.
Yeah, you should build a bonfire, by the way. Yeah, and absolutely you should commemorate Bonfire Night because it's old fashioned and it's patriotic. So
as Ronald Hutton in our previous episode said, it's also very ancient. The tradition of lighting bonfires is actually much older than. Around this time is much older.
But look out for the hedgehogs and you'll make Tom Holland happy.
Yeah, you will. Brilliant. All right. Well, so this is going out on the 4th of November. So 5th of November is tomorrow. I hope those listening who are going to Bonfire Nights have a wonderful time.
From the fireworks.
I hope those of you in foreign climes who don't have the fortune to celebrate this wonderful day, don't feel too bad about it. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.